ACT Radio is taped and produced at the KTEP studios at the University of Texas at El Paso. The views and opinions expressed on ACT Radio are solely those of its participants and do not necessarily reflect those of KTEP, its staff, or management.
Welcome to ACT, Animal Concerns of Texas. I'm Greg Lawson.
I'm Tom Lenny.
And I'm Liz Walsh.
Here on ACT Radio, we talk about how we humans relate to other animals.
We talk about how we use them for food, clothing, and entertainment, and how there are humane alternatives to these practices.
And we also discuss why a plant-based diet is the healthiest for humans and the best thing one can do for the environment.
So if you're concerned about the environment, if you're concerned about your health, if you're concerned about the way animals are treated, stay with us for Animal Concerns of Texas.
Coming up on today's show, we feature a conversation with Tracy McCorder, public health nutrition expert, author, and international lecturer. Tracy has been named a national food hero who is changing the way America eats for the better by Vegetarian Times, and her national bestseller, By Any Greens Necessary, was the number one vegan book on the Huffington Post. That's a little later in the show, but first some news.
Manga Bay reports that DNA testing has confirmed that an animal shot in February in Iowa's Buchanan County was in fact a wolf, according to the Iowa Department of Natural Resources. This is the first confirmed gray wolf in this state since 1925. Experts believe the wolf likely traveled south from Wisconsin or Minnesota, the latter of which has the largest wolf population in the lower 48 states. The Iowa wolf, which was a 60 to 70-pound healthy female, was shot and killed in February of this year by a hunter who mistook it for a coyote. Although wolves remain a protected species in Iowa, the hunter was not sighted because he believed the animal to be a coyote and has cooperated with authorities, including bringing the wolf to them in the first place. After being nearly exterminated across the continental U.S., gray wolves have returned to many states in the last two decades, both due to reintroductions and populations migrating from Canada. Gray wolves have been confirmed as far west as California and Oregon and as far east as Michigan. During the same time, wolves have been vindicated by science as key ecological species. As top predators, wolves not only manage prey populations of animals such as deer and elk, but also change their behavior, curbing unhindered grazing. For example, the wolf's return to Yellowstone National Park led to a resurgence in young forests and a subsequent explosion in biodiversity. But in many states, wolves are now actively hunted and trapped. A legislative writer stripped wolves of protection from the Endangered Species Act in 2011, the only animal ever to lose its protection this way. As of January this year, hunters and trappers have killed 2,567 gray wolves in the U.S. lower 48 states since 2011. In all, around 6,000 wolves are thought to inhabit the lower 48, up from the low point of 30 before the gray wolf gained protection in 1974.
Last September, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention warned that the nation faces potentially catastrophic consequences if it does not move rapidly to counter the growing threat of antibiotic-resistant infections, which sicken about 2 million Americans and kill an estimated 23,000 each year. Last week, the World Health Organization came out with a warning that resistance to antibiotics has become a major threat to public health. Bacteria are evolving so rapidly that antibiotics are, in many cases, losing their power, and infections are becoming untreatable. In this latest report, which is far from the first warning, the World Health Organization found that the problem has touched every region of the world. The report concluded that the problem is so serious that it threatens the achievements of modern medicine. Of the 51 tons of antibiotics consumed every day in the United States, about 80% goes into animal production. The widespread use of antibiotics in livestock is contributing to growing resistance to the drugs by bacteria. In December, the U.S. Food and Drug Administration enacted a voluntary program to phase out antibiotics used to make livestock grow bigger. An optimist might think that the unbelievable overdose of antibiotics to livestock could be stopped by government regulation. But a realist would think that there is no hope that the present Congress could pass legislation to reduce the problem.
The debate over whether the Keystone XL pipeline should be built has spanned months and months, polarizing politicians and scientists and pulling together advocates across the board. But as President Obama is deciding if the pipeline should be built, a shocking statistic about greenhouse gas emissions has come to light, shining a surprisingly positive image on the pipeline. After poring over numbers in an attempt to strip the politics from the pipeline debate and just provide facts, the State Department concluded that the Keystone Pipeline would emit 18.7 million metric tons of carbon dioxide a year. That is a lot of carbon. However, when compared to the grand scheme of carbon dioxide emissions, 18.7 million is a mere fraction of the 6.5 billion tons emitted by the U.S. every year. So it does beg the question, where are all these other emissions coming from? According to an article in the Washington Post, a large part comes from cows. In fact, cow production emits 10 times more greenhouse gases into the atmosphere a year than the almost 1,200-mile-long Keystone Pipeline. While putting up the fact that cow production is more environmentally destructive than the pipeline is a bit of a straw man defense, it does draw attention to the blaring hole in our country's perception of what causes environmental destruction. The pipeline, by nature of its association with burning crude oil, is immediately seen as an environmental culprit, while cow production is rarely, if ever, picked out of an environmental crime lineup. While looking to stop the potential damage that the Keystone XL pipeline could cause is important, if we as a nation are going to seriously begin addressing climate change, it is imperative that we also look to the existing causes, especially one that each individual has the power to help end. If you knew that your diet was contributing 10 times the amount of greenhouse gases than a transcontinental crude oil pipeline, wouldn't you feel compelled to change? Stay with us. Coming up next is a conversation with Tracy McWhirter, author of the national bestseller, By Any Greens Necessary. Joining us now on ACT Radio, Tracy McWhirter. Thanks for being with us, Tracy.
Thank you for having me.
Tracy, can we start out by having you tell our listeners how you got involved in vegetarian and veganism?
Sure. Well, it started for me, I guess my introduction was in seventh grade when I was a student at Sidwell Friends School, which a lot of people know now, probably because that's where the Obama girls are now going in D.C., and I was there from 3rd through 12th grade. And so our 7th grade teachers, two of them were vegetarian and wanted our class camping trip to be all vegetarian, and I thought this was a horrible idea, so I wrote a petition and tried to get my classmates to sign it, and a few of them did, but I was overruled by my teachers, and so we had what I thought was a horrible camping trip because it was all vegetarian. And so I thought they were crazy, never gave vegetarianism, you know, a second thought. And then fast forward 7 years, and I was a sophomore at Amherst College. And our Black Student Union brought Dick Gregory to campus to talk about the state of Black America. And instead, he talked about the plate of Black America and how unhealthfully most Black folks eat. He talked about how unhealthfully most Americans eat, period, but in particular, he was focusing on African Americans. And so, you know, I thought back to my crazy seventh grade teachers, and I thought, okay, well, Dick Gregory is crazy too. And I tried to tune him out. But what got me about his talk is that he graphically traced the path of a hamburger from a cow on a factory farm through the slaughterhouse process to a fast food restaurant to a clogged artery to a heart attack. And I had never heard anything like that before in my life. Anyone tying diet and disease together so closely. And so, you know, he planted a seed in my mind that I, you know, couldn't ignore. And so I immediately gave up hamburgers and hot dogs, but that lasted a week. But then I decided to read everything that I could when I got home a few months later for the summer about vegetarianism. And this was 1986, so there weren't, you know, nearly as many books as there are now. But one of them was his own book that he wrote in 1974, Cooking with Mother Nature. I read that and whatever else I could find. And my mother, who was in her 50s, and one of my sisters did. And by the end of the summer, we decided to become vegetarian. And I will just go a little further, because all of this is in the introduction to my By Any Greed Necessary book. But, you know, I think of relevance in particular to our conversation is that the next semester of my junior year I took away, and the first semester I was in Nairobi, Kenya, as a new vegetarian.
Uh-oh, that doesn't sound easy.
Right. And so I had to, you know, they did not accommodate me. And so I had to eat what they served, but it was my first experience with animals, living animals before they became food, that really had a different impact on me and made me know that I would become a vegetarian. And so I had two experiences with that, with a goat and with an antelope or a similar animal that had both have been recently killed. And so that kind of cemented for me that when I returned home, I would become vegetarian, and then ultimately vegan when I was able to finally let go of cheese. Hmm. So,
yeah, cheese is a big problem for a lot of folks.
I know it's so much more difficult, I think, for most people to see the animal, you know, before it's mm-hmm. consumed and actually have to think about what went into it. I was at a grocery store on the east side of town here recently, and I went in and I was just surprised because it was an Asian grocery store, and they had a bunch of fresh fish swimming around. And for some reason, that was just so much more offensive to me, like, or not more offensive, but it just made me more sad actually being able to see them there living as opposed to just, you know, already dead and ready to be consumed.
Something I find interesting about your story is the influence of Dick Gregory. And then tracing it further back, as I understand it, Dick Gregory was influenced by Dr. Martin Luther King and the nonviolent approach to life.
Right. Part of the reason that Dick Gregory became vegetarian is through an extension of his belief and practice of nonviolence, which, you know, he learned about and explored during the civil rights movement. And so this was a natural extension for him to think of nonviolence in relation to animals or to other animals. Yeah, so this was a huge influence on him and other folks who were in the struggle as well. And so what's interesting to me is that these issues are linked. And for me, they have always been linked as well. And most of the people I know, when and where I enter vegetarianism and veganism is through a large African-American vegetarian and vegan community that I learned about when I was when I came back to D.C. for that junior year and spent the next semester at Howard. And I learned about this large community of people who were eating this way and actually had the first all-vegan establishments in the nation's capital that they had started in the early 1980s. And so their eating this way was a result of their influence by Dick Gregory, many of them, but also their participation in the civil rights movement and the black liberation struggles. So these issues were all linked. And for Dick Gregory, you know, that was the same. And so it was a natural extension of his practice of nonviolence. And he actually influenced Coretta Scott King later in life to become vegan, and their son, Dexter King, to become vegan as well.
Mm-hmm. And yet, it seems to me that a lot of people get offended when we compare farmed animals to slavery.
Well, you know, I think Marjorie Spiegel wrote the seminal book about that, or one of the books about that. And, you know, I understand the offense because part of the issue was treating people, enslaved people, as chattel during enslavement in this country. So, mm-hmm. you know, of course you can understand the offense carries over. So, I mean, that's a valid, you know, that's
reaction.
A valid offense as far as I'm
yeah.
concerned.
Mm-hmm.
The issue is to me, and also I think, you know, that we have to understand that how can I put this? The oppressions are linked for sure, and more of what I experience is not linking enslavement and enslavement of animals, although, of course, there is a link. More of what I experience is people who are white people in particular. You know, I've been vegan for 27 years now, and for me, as I said, all of these issues are linked. Social justice issues, food justice issues are linked. And so what I have experienced traditionally is that it is not linked for many of the white activist, animal activist folks that I know, meaning that because I believe this is a social justice issue, I will go to anti-police brutality rallies, and I will go to anti-racism conferences and those types of things because they're all related. But I don't see white animal activists making these links traditionally and also being out there and rallying for things that are of concern to black folks being oppressed in this country. And so for me, that's the larger connection. That's what I focus on. And that's what I have an issue with. You know, those are the conversations that we are having today. Where is this connection and where is this link being made?
A lot of vegan activists and animal activists don't really see the connection that our food choices are harming people in the world, too. In that we're using up natural resources from the global south to grow our feed for our cattle and destroying the economies of many southern countries.
Exactly. And so people who say that they are concerned about impoverishment around the world, especially nations that are predominantly people of color, you know, don't understand or don't make the connection that eating meat and dairy is basically snatching away grains and other plant-based foods from people all over the world who could be well-fed with the stuff that we're growing and the land that we're using and the water that we're using to produce, you know, livestock or produce animals that we call livestock.
Right. And then thinking about the exploitation, too, of, for instance, undocumented immigrants and slaughterhouses and factory farms, you know, where these workers just don't have the rights that other workers have and aren't going to want to speak up about injustices or their injuries because, you know, they're afraid to be deported.
Absolutely. I think Eric Schlosser does a fabulous job of talking about that. And I actually excerpt some of what he said in my book. But from his book, Fast Food Nation, just talking about that being the most dangerous type of work in the country. So, it absolutely is an issue all around for the workers as well as the consumers.
You went on to get your master's degree in public health nutrition from NYU, and I was just curious, what was the climate like back then in terms of veganism, and was it part of the conversation?
Absolutely. Well, I actually went on to get my master's degree in 2001, so I did it a little later. I had a whole nother career in museum administration and editing before I decided to do this vegan work professionally, become what I call a professional vegan. So when I went to NYU, I went there because Marion Nestle, was the head of the department there, and I wanted to study under her and be mentored by her, which I was able to do. I got a full academic scholarship to attend, so, you know, that was all great. But when I got there, I found that I had to actually create my own concentration in plant-based nutrition because it did not exist. So I kind of knew it didn't exist, but I didn't realize some of the obstacles I would be up against in creating this focus, this concentration for myself. So I had to learn about meat and dairy-based nutrition along with learning about plant-based nutrition. And in the end, it's good because I can have any kind of conversation and debate about the two, right?
Right.
But at the time, you know, my question was, you know, to my professors, since you know that plant-based nutrition is the healthiest way to eat, the healthiest way we know to eat and have known this for decades, why do you still teach a meat and dairy-based curriculum?
Good question. Excellent question.
And not only that, but in some cases, professors were teaching plant-based nutrition from a place of lack and deficiency, I had known enough. I had already worked for PCRM by then as their public policy liaison. And just, you know, from my own experience, I knew enough to challenge this and to bring data when I was asked, you know. So the answer to that question was, well, you know, we are required to teach this curriculum to maintain our accreditation through the American Dietetic Association, which must teach what the USDA determines it to teach, which is a meat and dairy-based curriculum because the USDA's role is to promote meat and dairy, regardless of whether it is healthy for the populace or not. And so that was it in a nutshell. And so that was pretty much, you know, my encounter my first year.
Well, were you kind of shocked that the university would hold greater importance over following a federal agency's recommendation, flawed recommendations, instead of putting out the correct diet?
I was shocked about that at the time. And I was actually told, one professor in particular complained because I challenged her when she did talk about plant-based nutrition. And I was told to consider whether I wanted to be right or whether I wanted to graduate. You know? And so, you know, and then one of my professors was actually worked for the dairy industry and helped them come up with the Got Milk campaign.
Oh.
So I had those experiences. I also had some very supportive professors. Dr. Nessel was very supportive, in fact. But I did have to kind of figure out my way in this program because it was not plant-centered. Probably now it is much more. Again, this was 14 years ago. And, you know, things are changing so rapidly.
It's beginning to sound to me like being a professional vegan might be the most dangerous job in the country.
Well, tell us a little bit about your book and how you came to write By Any Greens Necessary.
Sure. I'm a writer at heart. And so I knew that my advocacy work was going to be, through writing and speaking. So I have this book in me for a very long time, and I chose to, in the subtitle, to focus on African-American women in terms of food, in terms of diet, because it hadn't been done before, obviously because I'm a Black woman public health nutritionist, and because while we are fabulous, we happen to be the unhealthiest demographic in the country. And so we needed to be targeted. And I felt like I was the best person, you know, for these reasons to do that, or one of the best people to do it. No, I thought I was the best to do it.
Yeah, go ahead and say it.
Right. And so that's why I wrote the book. And it's been very, you know, it's done well. It's been very well received. And I came up with the title because I wanted it to represent Blackness. I wanted it to represent urgency. Political activism. I wanted it to be memorable and clever.
Yeah, and I think you succeeded. It's a great title.
Yeah.
Thank you.
I was really surprised by the statistics I saw at your website that 50% of Black women are obese.
Right, right.
Yeah, that's
80%
amazing.
Are overweight,
yeah,
and
that's...
50% are obese. Yeah, there are a lot of reasons for that, you know, and as you know, most Americans have challenges when it comes to weight and eating the standard American diet.
Even some vegans.
So, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Because, you know, Coke and Oreo cookies are vegan, right? And white rice is vegan. So that's definitely true. But yeah, so there are a lot of reasons. There are a lot of reasons for that. And that's something that not only affects the women themselves, but affects, you know, the families and communities. And so it's definitely something that I want to help women change so that we can turn the situation around.
Yeah, that's a very good point that, you know, a lot of times people eat what their mothers cooked, and they're very resistant to eating anything that their mother doesn't cook, one, because they're used to it, and that's the flavors they grew up on, and number two, because their mom gets upset when they go to change their lifestyle and what they want to cook. I mean, I think all of us have experienced our mom's reactions, like, oh, so you're not going to eat this that I make anymore, you know, and you're like, oh, I know it's your special dish, but no, you know, so... And it is. Yeah. It is. females have traditionally been responsible for a lot of the cooking, so reaching out to the women so that they can provide better examples for their family, I think, is a great, great idea.
Yeah, thank you. My grandmother definitely had that reaction. She went over there for Sunday dinners, and she was like, oh, so y'all done got sanctified. To my mother, she said, and Mary, you done joined up. I mean, she just was undone. But eventually, she came around, and she actually started to make some of her famous desserts for me. When she would call me up and say, bring over your ingredients. I want to make you a pie. And that would be our time together, you know. And so she came around. But my mother was in her 50s, and she's from Camden, South Carolina, and she decided to become vegan along with me. So, and she's now 77 and has no chronic diseases, no overweight, great. No high blood pressure, nothing. But, and she's one of 14, and wow. Of the ones who have survived, she's the only one that doesn't have chronic disease, mm-hmm. And both of her parents died of chronic disease. I never met my grandparents on her side. So she's a living example of the power of changing how you eat.
Well, it seems like you've certainly had great success with increasing the number of African-American vegans and vegetarians. What do you think is one of the main keys to success for this particular population?
Yeah, I think that it's that once people, my experience has been that through teaching classes and doing talks is that once people are informed, they want to start doing something. And so I focus on meeting people where they are and showing them how to add rather than subtract first. And I'm not self-righteous about it. When I first started, I was very self-righteous. And now I'm just about, you know, I'm still as passionate, of course, about wanting to help people eat healthier. But my take now or my approach now is to give people information so that they can make informed decisions. And that is something that I think people appreciate. They tell me that they appreciate that. And then helping them, you know, figure out how to make it affordable, where to purchase it, how to make it tasty for their kids, for themselves, that kind of thing. So I cover all of the bases, you know, to really try to get them all the information and resources they need to make this change. And also just telling them that the government, that the USDA is duping them is not a surprise, you know, because the government is, you know, this is not a surprise. So once they hear that, they're like, okay, you know, and immediately the justice thing comes up. Well, this is so wrong, and why haven't I been told this? Well, you know, now you can take control, and this is how you do it.
We've been talking with Tracy McCorder, public health nutrition expert, author, and international lecturer. Tracy, can you tell
our professional vegan.
And professional vegan. Tracy, can you tell our listeners where they can go to learn more about your book and your vegan boot camp classes and your blog?
Yes, they can go to byanygreensnecessary.com. That's my website and blog. They can find me on Twitter at byanygreens and on Facebook at byanygreensnecessary. And my book is everywhere. So Amazon is probably the best bet, though.
Thank goodness it is. Thanks for being with us, Tracy.
Thank you, Tracy.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Tracy's book has a wealth of information about veganism and vegetarian diets. If you'd like some additional information, you can go to the website of the Vegetarian Society of El Paso at vsep.org.
And if you'd like to listen to some of the past shows of ACK Radio, you can find them at ktep.org. Just click on the Listen button. I'm Tom Linney.
I'm Liz Walsh.
And I'm Greg Lawson. For the animals, the earth, and a healthier humanity, thanks for listening to Animal Concerns of Texas.